we're seeing a hardening positioning of the Russians on a lot of the Arctic issues.
Arctic issues take center stage at an oceans conference in Seward. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 21st of May. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, ice and water trap a Yukon River couple in their home.
We're not going to starve, but our supplies are running out. We're out of a lot of things, and it's getting low.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century, member FDIC, equal housing lender, and by EcoTrust, working to encourage economic development, healthy communities, and healthy salmon in the Copper River watershed, on the web at ecotrust.org/copper river.
Governor Sarah Palin today followed through on her threat to veto federal stimulus money for energy conservation projects. The governor is giving up more than $28 million from the U.S. Department of Energy. Karen Rehfeld is the state's budget director. She says Palin is concerned the money would be attached to a condition that Palin advocate for building codes in local communities. Rehfeld says the governor would not have to require the codes be adopted.
Her concern is that she does not want to have to assure the U.S. Department of Energy that she is going to actively promote the adoption of a statewide code, a local code that meets these standards, because she feels strongly that that is a local government decision.
Democratic Senator Mark Begich, who voted for the stimulus package, said in a statement today, the notion about some onerous federal mandate seems to be little more than a political red herring targeted at an agenda other than Alaska's. Quote, Palin backed down from her initial pledge to reject a third of the $1 billion stimulus package Congress offered the state. Today's veto of the energy funds came as part of other minor cuts to $11 billion in spending the legislature approved during this year's session. Four of 11 capital projects vetoed by Palin today were in southeast Alaska. The governor removed two projects in Sitka and one in Ketchikan that were to be funded by cruise ship head taxes. She also reduced the amount of money available for another Ketchikan head tax project. The legislature funded about 50 cruise ship projects this year. Rehfeld says that was more than Palin wanted.
Ketchikan and Sitka had some other projects in the budget, and we feel that these ones can wait in the fund, be considered in the next budget cycle. I know that through Senate Finance, in-house finance, both, they're very interested in looking at sort of the policy direction for how we actually decide what projects go into the budget, and we would look forward to that.
Sitka lawmaker Bert Stedman oversaw development of the capital budget as co-chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. He says the vetoes save no money because the head tax funds will simply sit in an account until they're spent.
Sitka and Ketchikan are two of the five main communities that the visitors from the cruise ships stop by. So I think when you look at the allocation of head tax money, those two communities, particularly Sitka, those two communities have definitely been shorted in their share of the head tax money. And this is just going to exasperate that issue.
Most of the cruise ship projects funded by the legislature remain in the capital budget. They range from a ship tie-up system in Hoonah to restrooms in Haines to railroad station improvements in Wasilla. The legislature has the authority to override the governor's vetoes at the start of their next session, scheduled for January of 2010, but leaders have previously indicated that they are unlikely to do that. The 33rd Annual Conference of the Center for Oceans and Law Policy is underway at the Marine Education Center in Seward. The conference in previous years has been in Singapore, Germany, and Ireland. Organizers say it's an attempt to bring together people from a variety of fields, such as law, science, and politics, to discuss the status of oceans. KDLL's Ben Stanton reports.
Presenters are from the U.S., Canada, and several foreign countries. They're talking about shipping routes, environmental climate change, and diplomacy. Here at the opening reception at their hotel, the group gathers. Mead Treadwell chairs the U.S. Arctic Research Commission. In his welcome, Treadwell mentions the importance of the Arctic area for the United States.
We have a role in America and in the world. We help feed the nation. We help defend the nation. We help fuel the nation. Our location is key to air transport.
The focus of this conference is changes in the Arctic environment. Treadwell says while the conference is in different parts of the world every year, it's appropriate that Seward, Alaska was chosen.
This city is named after the man who made America an Arctic nation.
An environmental scientist, Stephen Macko, is from the University of Virginia. He says pollock might do very well in a warmer ocean, but other species of fish would do poorly. He says an increasingly acidic ocean would be made worse quickly. It's hard to know how the fish will be affected because it's hard to know how many fish there are.
Fish are going to migrate in. There's a lot of evidence that fish from warmer waters that are cool originally, but now they're warming, are migrating north. And as they migrate north, are we going to establish new fisheries? Sure. Are we going to overfish them? You bet. Because we won't know how many fish there are, how fast they're going to be growing in that ecosystem. What are they going to be eating? They're not going to be eating the ice algae. They're going to be eating these coccolithophores that are dissolving up in the acidic oceans.
The environment is not the only aspect of change. Rob Hubert from the Center for Military and Strategic Studies in Calgary discusses growing military capabilities in the Arctic Ocean.
The biggest concern I have is that we're not focusing enough on some of these more disturbing signs. I mean, we're seeing a hardening positioning of the Russians on a lot of the Arctic issues. If you read their documents, they just released one about 2 weeks ago, where they're saying their strength as a re-emerging power is the Arctic. They will cooperate, but as long as everybody ultimately agrees with them.
Those in attendance are also interested in the law of the sea, an international treaty explaining how countries work together for commerce and otherwise. The United States has not yet ratified the treaty. Many here expect that if the U.S. Senate got the issue on their calendar, it will be approved by a wide margin. These issues are only the beginning. The conference continues through Saturday. In Seward, I'm Ben Stanton.
An Eagle area couple is trapped at their homestead on the Yukon River by ice and high water. Wayne and Scarlett Hall live about 6 miles downstream from Eagle, near the site of an ice jam that caused the worst flooding on record earlier this month. Scarlett Hall says the couple's cabin was not flooded, but heavy ice on shore has effectively cut them off from getting upriver for supplies.
At this point, you're risking life and limb to cross this ice. I mean, it towers up to 20, 25 feet tall in spots, and it's getting rotten.
Hall says she and her husband, a Yukon Quest veteran, have been trying unsuccessfully to make their way through the jumble of ice to the river so they can meet a supply boat from Eagle. Scarlett Hall says their property is bounded by floodwaters that are keeping them from getting out overland.
So we're literally stranded here until the ice melts enough that the lowlands drain and we can work through the ice.
The Halls run Bush Alaska Expeditions, a winter sled dog tour operation. Scarlett Hall says so far they're surviving on what they have stocked up at their cabin.
We're not going to starve, but our supplies are running out. We're out of a lot of things, and it's getting low. So we were hoping for a one-time drop of supplies to help bolster what we've got. We're down to a lot of dried beans and rice, and you get tired of that after a while.
Hall says a helicopter was supposed to bring in some of the food donated to Eagle, but it hasn't arrived yet. She says the couple doesn't want to be rescued.
We don't want to get a helicopter lift out. We're here with 20 dogs. We have a garden in. We still have fish hanging.
Hall says it normally only takes a short period after breakup before they can get out on the river. She says it may take as long as a month for that to happen this year. The Halls lost 2 power boats and their fish wheel to the ice and flooding. They say that's a hardship, but nothing like what friends in Eagle who lost their homes have suffered. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Juneau neighborhood bands together to save a beloved tree.
They just needed a win-win for the Gipper, Draw their line in the sand and say we're saving this one, and I'm glad that we could make that happen for them.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Want to break your tobacco addiction? Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-888-842-QUIT. Register for free Quit Line counseling and nicotine replacement patches. The combined counseling and patches increase your chances of quitting for good. Trained quit coaches will help you set a quit date and send you information. Free quit services are available to all Alaskans. This message is from the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line, 1-888-842-7848.
Senator Lisa Murkowski has received assurance from the Air Force that it will work with the Fairbanks Borough on a coal-to-liquid study. Borough and Air Force officials have been looking at the potential of a coal-to-liquids plant at Eielson Air Force Base, but Murkowski says there's been little action since the Air Force got a $10 million earmark for research a year ago. Murkowski says she questioned Undersecretary for Air Force Construction Projects Kathleen Ferguson about the research at a recent subcommittee hearing.
It was admitted that, in fact, there had not been very good communication between the Air Force and the Fairbanks North Star Borough. There was not necessarily an apology for that, but just a recognition that perhaps there had been some confusion.
Murkowski says the study earmark language is pretty straightforward, and that meetings between the Air Force and borough officials have been held in recent days. The Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation, or FEDCO, has already spent $500,000 on its own coal-to-liquids feasibility study, and Murkowski says it's important the Air Force considers that.
FEDC wants to make sure that it's done smart, wants to make sure that the studies aren't duplicative, that they're going in the right way. So I think they wanted to have an opportunity to be a participant in how these studies might move forward or at least be able to offer their suggestions.
The coal-to-liquids research follows on a Department of Defense initiative to find oil alternatives to power its operations. The local plan is to build a facility at Eielson that would turn Healy area coal into fuels to meet military and civilian needs. The conversion technology called Fischer-Tropsch is well proven, but a plant would be very expensive to build and operate, and it's unclear how large quantities of byproduct carbon emissions would be handled. Federal crews are conducting research in Angoon this summer on possible impacts of a community airport. State officials have proposed building the facility in a wilderness area near the Admiralty Island Village. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Angoon is about halfway between Juneau and Sitka on the west side of Admiralty Island. The Tlingit Village is only accessible by floatplane, ferry, and private boat. The Federal Aviation Administration is looking at what it would mean to build a small airport there. It's conducting research this summer for an environmental impact statement needed to move the project forward. Leslie Gray is the FAA's project manager.
We're currently out in the field gathering lots of information on geomorphology and biology and fisheries and wetlands and vegetation so that we can study the impacts of not only that alternative that the state and community came up with, but other alternatives that need to be analyzed, what impacts those alternatives would have on those kinds of resources, including socioeconomic impacts as well, and those human impacts along with biological impacts.
Local and state officials spent several years coming up with plans for the proposed 3,300-foot runway. They identified a 270-acre site southeast across Favorite Bay from Angoon, which would be accessed by a new road. One of the alternative sites is to the east and the other to the southeast. Grace says the research is considering the Tlingit Village's human history.
The DOT did some preliminary studies and found that the sites they liked and the community liked could most likely avoid cultural sites, and we will be doing some field work to verify that that would be the case.
You mean going out and looking to see what's there or talking to people about oral history or both?
Certainly there'll be some field work, some sampling on the ground, areas where they would suspect there would be some, have been some cultural activity. And then there will actually be some interviews with local residents and cultural bearers that have the local knowledge of the cultural resources.
The State Transportation Department has been working on the project on and off since the 80s. Planner Vern Skagerberg says finding a location was difficult. Like elsewhere in Southeast, the area lacks large parcels of flat, dry land.
There are some additional challenges in Angoon because they're located immediately adjacent to Admiralty Island National Monument and the wilderness area. And the town site, the community's property, is fairly limited and oriented in such a way that it's rather difficult to locate an airport there.
The chosen site includes land within Admiralty Island National Monument. Federal law allows for the use, but the location could still bring challenges. Skaggerberg says there's no question the community needs an airport. It's the largest town in Southeast without a landing strip.
Year-round, 24-hour-a-day air service is really the issue for Angoon. They don't have access to a whole lot of medical facilities in town. There are quite a few medevacs that go on over there. And they're limited, because all they have is float plane service now, they're limited to daytime service and, to some extent, fair weather service.
Results of the summer's research will be made available in August or September. The information will be posted on the project's FAA website. If the chosen location passes scrutiny, final design could begin. Funding is also needed. Previous estimates for the airport, apron, and access road have been around $30 million. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
An offshoot of Barack Obama's grassroots campaign organization is gearing back up in Alaska just in time to help support the president's agenda as it goes through Congress. Jonathan Teeters is the director of Organizing for America in Alaska. Teeters has embarked on a five-city listening tour around the state. Besides the three largest cities of Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau, he's also going to visit Dillingham and Kodiak.
In Dillingham, we're not going to use the same tools or the same strategies as we're going to use in downtown Anchorage or, you know, in Fairbanks on the university campus. It's going to be different. And so, for me, I really wanted to hear what those differences might be. And between Kodiak and Dillingham, I get a pretty good sampling of what happens when you're, you know, how people want to organize when they're not in one of the urban centers in this state.
So the Organizing for America tour is an initiative of the president. It's run by the Democratic National Committee. But Teeter says everyone is welcome, just as they were during the campaign last year.
Republican, Democrat, Green, Independent, whatever you might be, this is really about circling the wagons and moving America forward. And so that's not a partisan thing. I'm trying hard to make sure that this doesn't become just another Democratic Party initiative.
The Organizing for America campaign is gearing up as the president tries to make his agenda a reality by addressing America's woeful health care system and the predatory practices of credit card companies, among other issues. Teeter says he wants to hear from regular Alaskans about the topics and more.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Sooner or later, the H1N1 swine flu will come to Alaska. There are simple ways to avoid catching or spreading this or any virus. Wash your hands often with soap and water or use a waterless hand cleaner. Cough into your sleeve or into a tissue rather than your hands. Stay at home if you're sick and contact your health care provider. More information is available on the state website at pandemicflu.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska.
Interior Regional Native Corporation Doyon and several partners are moving ahead with natural gas exploration in the Nanana Basin. Doyon Vice President of Lands and Resources Jim Merry says the company and partners Yucibeli, Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, and Rampart Energy of Colorado are undertaking an exploratory drilling operation starting next month.
We've contracted to drill an 11,000-foot well a few miles west of Nanana, looking for conventional natural gas. That project should start sometime in June.
Mary says the $15 million well targets an area of high gas potential determined through seismic testing that indicated recoverable gas reserves in the broader Nanana Basin study area at 1 to 3 trillion cubic feet. Mary says work is underway to assess the drill site.
There's an existing winter trail and right-of-way owned by the city of Nanana, which we will be using about 3 miles of that existing trail. It's in the process of being improved right now. And then we will jog off of that a little bit up to the north, about a half a mile to the well site.
Mary says 40 to 60 people will be working on site during the drill operation, which is expected to span up to 7 weeks. He says if the test well hits gas, it will take 1 to 3 years to assess results before a decision is made on development. The potential includes local power generation at Nenana and pipelines to Fairbanks or Anchorage. Construction on the new downtown transportation center in Juneau may be a go, but not everyone in the neighborhood, Telephone Hill, has been keen to green light the project. Since the transit center and parking garage were first proposed, questions and critiques have abounded. Are there potential health hazards from drilling and dust? Does Juneau even need another garage downtown? And what will become of the tree? K2's Rebecca Shear has the answer.
That tree is a really beautiful rowan tree, which is a European mountain ash, and it's been a kind of landmark here in the neighborhood for a long time.
Shel Silverstein's classic story, The Giving Tree, begins, "There once was a tree, and she loved a little boy." But for Telephone Hill residents like Peggy Pijon, it's more like there once was a neighborhood, and they loved a little tree.
It's never been pollarded for the gardeners in the crowd.
Oh, pollarded. I'm not a gardener in the crowd. What's pollarded?
Well, they're cut back in a certain way, but it has a particularly wonderful, full form.
Okay, so it's more like there once was a neighborhood and they loved a big tree.
The big, beautiful tree.
And the neighborhood, like the little boy, was happy. Until, Pijon says, the city began blasting the hill to make way for the transit center and parking garage. I notice it's tied up in a yellow ribbon. What's the meaning of that?
That yellow ribbon stands for all of the promises that they've broken to us all along. They basically promised us from the beginning of the job that this tree would be allowed to continue to stand.
We're standing at the end of Dixon Street, where Pijon has rented a house from the state ever since the site was selected for a Juneau government center in the 1980s. But then the economy tanked and the plans were put on hold, and years later, Pijon says another broken promise involves the street she's called home for 2 decades.
They had told us that they were absolutely not going to connect Dixon Street with the parking garage. They said that they would not do that.
But if we hand the story over to city engineer Rory Watt.
As we developed the plans for the project, we decided at the assembly level to connect Dixon Street, which is at the top of the hill, into the top of the garage.
And a consequence of that decision, he says, was most likely doing away with the tree.
The advice that I've got is that we're probably going to undermine the roots, and even if we avoid it, it probably wouldn't live.
The city did try to save other plants on the hill. They conducted a special historic plant inventory.
This nice little report here.
The inventory identified plants, Watt says,
that people were sensitive about, and they're essentially historic plants that were planted by old-timers in the early part of Juneau's history.
Like this one lilac bush, which the city uprooted and relocated.
And maybe even a rhododendron, I'm not sure. We either protected it or moved it.
But the unpollarded mountain ash
was not in this report, and so I think, you know, we didn't have any special knowledge that it's got enduring historical importance.
Watt insists he never promised to save the ash, known around the city engineer's office as the yellow ribbon tree.
I certainly didn't promise that to anyone. Whether somebody else did, I don't know.
But he says he sympathizes with the people on Telephone Hill.
You know, a fair number of people that live up there oppose the project in the planning stages and haven't been real happy. And I think over time, people that rent the houses on the hill feel like caretakers of the property. And it's my job to try and see if I can get something for everyone and try and make projects work out well for everyone.
As for how this project is working out,
so where we are, we're level with what would be the top of the parking garage.
The city is going ahead with the connection to Dixon Street.
Right. And actually, there's going to be a small bridge that's going to be connecting Dixon Street here to that parking garage.
So project manager Jeff Wilson stresses the connection is primarily for maintenance vehicles and emergencies. As for the yellow ribbon tree,
we relocated the whole road. We pushed the road this way. And we are done. The tree is staying right where it is. We're keeping the tree. We've redesigned everything to keep the tree there.
Wilson and Watt say there had been enough controversy already, and avoiding this one was best for the city and the neighborhood.
I think in my mind that they just needed win-win for the Gipper, you know. Draw their line in the sand and say we're saving this one, and I'm glad that we could make that happen for them.
And Peggy Pigeon is glad as well.
It took a lot of people writing and calling, and the tree is going to get to stay where it is, and we're just really, really thankful to have it.
The tree in Silverstein's book, you may recall, ended as just an old stump. But in this story, the neighborhood wanted the tree to stand, and the tree did. And the neighborhood was happy. In Juneau, I'm Rebecca Shear.
An air search is underway for an overdue climber on Denali. An Air National Guard HC-130 Hercules was dispatched this morning in efforts to locate Gerald Myers, a 41-year-old solo climber from Colorado. Cloud cover and high winds at the mountain's upper elevations prevented a sighting of Myers. Myers began a solo bid to reach the summit on Tuesday. He was spotted by other climbers and by park rangers on that day and was seen by climbing parties at the 20,000-foot level on Wednesday. Myers did not return to high camp Wednesday night. At the time, weather high on the mountain was deteriorating with winds gusting 40 to 50 miles an hour. Park Service officials say that it is expected that Myers was carrying minimal survival gear at the time of his disappearance. Myers was traveling light and did not appear to take a sleeping bag, thermal pad, or a stove for melting snow. It is unknown how much food or water he had in his pack. Aerial searching will continue as visibility and winds allow. Currently, visibility is obscured by clouds with wind gusting at 45 miles per hour near the summit. And the five jet skiers blazing the trail for a 2,000-mile race from Anchorage to Bristol Bay were waylaid before they got out of Cook Inlet. And it looks like they'll be on shore until Friday morning. John Lang, who calls himself a goodwill ambassador on the Paving the Way expedition for the Wet Dog Race, said they didn't plan on stopping at Anchor Point, but wound up there anyway.
When we were coming down Cook Inlet, we stopped for fuel, put some extra fuel in, and somehow we ended up picking up some water on the trip, and it plugged the injectors on a couple of the boats. So we pulled into a river, got hauled out by a trailer, and we're doing some assessment now, and hopefully we'll be back on the water by high tide. We'll get those few mechanical problems resolved, and we'll get on our way.
Lang said the problems will keep them in Anchor Point another night. He said the watercraft will be pulled from the water and have all the fuel removed from the tanks. The racers and their support crew will then install water separators in the fuel lines before putting them back in the water on Friday morning. The next stop is Port Graham near the tip of the Kenai Peninsula, and then they'll embark on the 100-mile leg to Kodiak. Their final stop is Iliamna. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Ben Stanton in Seward, Dan Broth in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld and Rebecca Shear in Juneau, and Jay Barrett in Kodiak. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. Our intern is Susanna Caldwell, and I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by Comfort Suites Anchorage International Airport. Comfort Suites, an all suites hotel, is now open with a 24-hour shuttle service, indoor pool, and high-speed internet access. Reservations at 243-8080. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.